looked around.
I was going to make some popcorn and watch the news. Want to join me?
Sure, Fred said, following her, as if glad to be told what to do. Thank you.
Well, isn't this nice, Evenell thought as they sat on the couch with a bowl of popcorn. They watched the 11 o'clock news together, and then Fred washed the popcorn bowl.
I'll see you in the morning, Evenell said as she took a can of Coke from the refrigerator.
She liked to open it and leave it on her bedside table and then drink it flat first thing in the morning.
The bathroom's down the hall.
Wait, Evenell turned around. Is it true that you once gave my father a spoon when you were kids, and that he used it to dig a quarter out of the dirt when he saw something shiny, and he used the quarter to go to the movies, and that's where he met my mother?
It's true that I gave him a spoon. I don't have the power to make things all better, Fred.
Oh, I understand, he said quickly, looking down and folding the dish towel in his hands.
I was just asking.
Evenell suddenly realized the real reason he was there. Most people tried to avoid her because she gave them things. Fred wanted to move in, to be closer, on the off chance she was going to produce something that would make sense out of everything happening with James, that spoon that was going to help him dig out of this. Sydney, Bay, and Claire sat on the porch that Sunday, eating extra cinnamon buns that Claire had made from her regular Sunday order to the coffee house. It was hot, and things were out of whack. Doorknobs that everyone swore were on the right side of the doors were actually on the left. Butter melted in the refrigerator. Things weren't being said and were left to stew in the air.
"There's Evenell," Sydney said, and Claire turned to see her coming up the sidewalk.
Evenell walked up the steps, smiling.
"Your mother had two beautiful girls. I'll give her that. But you two don't look so chipper."
"It's the first heat wave. It makes everyone cranky," Claire said as she poured Evenell a glass of iced tea from the pitcher she'd brought outside.
"How have you been? I haven't seen you in a couple of days."
Evenell took the glass and sat in the wicker rocker by Claire.
"I've had a guest."
"Who?"
"Fred Walker is staying with me."
"Oh," Claire said, surprised. "Are you okay with that?"
"I'm fine with it."
"I guess the rose geranium wine didn't work." Evenell shrugged and sipped her tea.
"He never used it."
Claire glanced over to the house next door.
"Do you think Fred would let me buy it back?"
"I don't see why not. Got another customer for it?"
"No."
Sydney piped in and said, "She probably wants to use it on Tyler." Claire gave her a look, but it was only half-hearted. She was right, after all.
Evenell put her tea down and rooted through her tote bag.
"I came because I had to give you this," she said,
finally bringing out a white headband and handing it to Claire.
"Fred tried to talk me out of giving it to you. He said you use combs, not headbands, that headbands were for people with short hair. He doesn't understand. This is what I had to give you. It's been a while since I've lived with a man. I forgot how stubborn they can be. They smell right nice, though."
Sydney and Claire exchanged glances.
"Evenell, you do know Fred is gay, don't you?"
Claire asked gently.
"Of course,"
she said, laughing, looking happier and lighter than Claire had seen her in ages.
"But it's nice to know that you two aren't the only ones who like having me around. So tell me, Sydney, how is work?"
Sydney and Bay were sitting on the porch swing, and Sydney was using one bare foot to gently rock them back and forth.
"I have you to thank for it. If you hadn't given me that shirt I returned, I never would have gone into the white door to see if they had an open booth."
"Fred said he saw you a couple of times last week getting lunch for the girls, and once he saw you sweeping up."
"That's all I'm good for right now."
"What's the matter?" Claire asked, aware that Sydney had been mopey lately.
She'd been so excited about her job at the White Door at first, but as the days wore on, she came home earlier and earlier, smiling less and less. Claire had mixed feelings about Sydney's new job. Claire liked working with Sydney, liked having her around. But Sydney had a light to her when she talked of hair. She left every morning with so much hope. The clientele at the White Door all seemed to know the Clarks and the Madisons. I had a visit from Hunter John my third day. Apparently, some people, and I'm not naming names, aren't happy with that and spread the word. Not that I was busy before, but there seems to be a reason for it now. Did you cut his hair? No, he wouldn't let me. It's a shame because I do great men's cuts, Sydney said. I was the one who cut Tyler's hair. You were? Uh-huh, and Bay's, and my own. So people have been snubbing you? Claire asked. Not even giving you a chance? If this keeps up, I'm not going to be able to keep the booth. But maybe it's just as well, Sydney said, putting her arm around Bay. I'll get to spend more time with Bay. And I'll be free to help you anytime you want. Claire had been in a hair salon 3 times in her adult life, only when her hair would get too long to control and she needed a couple of inches taken off. She went to Mavis Adler's Salon of Style on the highway. Mavis used to make special house calls to cut Claire's grandmother's hair, and if Mavis was good enough for her grandmother, she was good enough for Claire. Claire didn't consider herself a rube, and she'd passed by the White Door countless times. But when she walked in and found leather couches and original artwork and a gaggle of some of the more wealthy women in town, some of whom she'd catered brunches, teas, and lunches for, she suddenly felt frighteningly out of place. She spotted Sydney in the back, sweeping hair from around another stylist's chair, looking beautiful and self-contained. She looked so alone, which was all well and good for Claire, but not for Sydney. Sydney saw her and immediately walked to the reception area. Claire, what's wrong? Where's Bay? Is she okay? She's fine. I asked Evenel to watch her for an hour or two. Why? Because I want you to cut my hair. A crowd of stylists and patrons gathered around Sydney and Claire. Rebecca, the owner of the White Door, stood like an instructor, waiting for Sydney to begin. Whispers of Claire's beautiful long hair and Sydney's untested abilities floated around like dust motes. "Do you trust me?" Sydney asked, as she pumped up the chair after she'd washed Claire's hair. Claire met her sister's eyes in the mirror. Yes, she said. Sydney turned her around, away from the mirror. Over the next few minutes, Claire's hair felt lighter and lighter as wet chunks of dark hair fell onto the smock she was wearing, looking like thin strips of molasses candy. Every so often, Rebecca would ask Sydney a question, and Sydney would answer confidently, using words like beveled cut and wisps of bangs. Claire didn't understand what it meant. It made her think of bevel-cut crystal bowls and wisps of steam rising from curried rice. When Sydney finally turned the chair back around, the people around her applauded. Claire couldn't believe what she saw. Sydney had taken off at least 12 inches of length. The cut angled down so that it was longer in the front, but high and full in the back. The thin bangs made Claire's eyes look beautiful and sparkling, not flat and judgmental. There in the mirror was someone who looked like Claire had always wanted to be. Sydney didn't ask her if she liked it. There was no question. It was a transformation performed by a master. Everyone was looking at Sydney with such awe, and Sydney was shining like polished silver. Claire felt tears come to her eyes. A joy of birth, of redemption. Somewhere deep inside her, Claire had always known. It had been the source of all her jealousy when they were kids. Sydney had been born here. That was a gift. And this had always been inside Sydney, just waiting for her to embrace it.
"You can't deny it anymore," Claire said.
"Deny what?" Sydney asked.
"This is your Waverley magic."
Part 2. Insight. Chapter 7. Lester Hopkins sat in an aluminum lawn chair under the chestnut tree in his front yard. A ribbon of dust followed a car in the distance, coming up the long driveway to the house next to the dairy. Lester had come back from his stroke last year with a limp and a corner of his mouth that wouldn't quite turn up, so he kept a handkerchief handy to wipe away the spittle that collected there. Didn't want to offend the ladies. He spent a lot of time sitting these days, which he didn't mind so much. It gave him time to think. Truth be told, he had always looked forward to this time in his life. When he was a boy, his grandfather lived the life of Riley, his days full of big breakfasts, hunting when he felt like it, sleeping in the afternoons, and picking the banjo in the evenings. That, Lester thought, was the way to live. You even got money in the mail every month, like clockwork. So Lester decided early on that he wanted to grow up and be retired. But there were a few glitches along the way. He had to work harder than he imagined after his father died when Lester was 17, which left him to run the dairy by himself. And he and his wife were blessed with only one son. But his son married a hard-working woman, and they all lived there in the house, and his son had a son, and everything was all right. But then Lester's wife got the cancer, and his son died in a car accident 2 years later. Lost and grieving, his daughter-in-law wanted to move to Tuscaloosa, where her sister lived. But Henry, Lester's grandson, then 11 years old, wanted to stay. So Lester had known only two things of constant faith: his farm and Henry. As the car came closer, Lester heard the screen door bang shut. He turned to see that Henry had come out of the front of the house to see who it was. It was too late for business. The sun was nearly set. Henry called out, "Are you expecting something, Pap?"
"My ship to come in, but that ain't it."
Henry walked down to the chestnut tree and stood beside Lester. Lester looked over at him. He was a handsome boy, but like all Hopkins men, he was born old and would spend his whole life waiting for his body to catch up. This was the reason all Hopkins men married older women. Henry was taking his time, though, and Lester had taken to helping him along a little. Lester would tell Henry to lead the elementary school tours of the dairy if the teachers were the right age and unmarried. And the decorating committee at church consisted of mostly divorced women, so Lester let them come out to collect hay in the fall and holly in the winter, and he always made Henry go out to help them. But nothing ever took. Solid and sure of himself, hard-working and kind-hearted, Henry was quite a catch, if only he wasn't so happy with himself. But that's what happens when you're born old. The car came to a stop. Lester didn't recognize the driver, but he did recognize the woman getting out of the passenger seat. He cackled. He always liked for Even L. Franklin to come by. It was like finding a robin in the winter.
"Looks like Even L. needs to give us something."
The man stayed in the car as Even L. crossed the yard.
"Lester," she said, stopping in front of him and putting her hands on her hips. "You look better every time I see you."
"They have a cure for cataracts now, you know," he teased.
She smiled. "Devil man.
What brings you out this way?"
"I needed to give you this."
She reached into her bag of goodies and handed him a jar of maraschino cherries. Lester looked over to Henry, who was trying to hide his smile.
"Well, I haven't had these in a long time. Thank you, Evenel."
"You're welcome."
"Say, who's that? Who brought you?"
"That's Fred from the grocery store. He's been staying with me, It's been real nice.
Would you two like to stay for dinner? Henry asked. Yvonne made potato cakes.
Yvonne was their housekeeper.
Henry had hired her after Lester's stroke last year. She was married, of course. Lester would have hired someone single.
No, thank you. I have to get along, Evenell said. I'll see you at the 4th of July celebration.
We'll be there,
Lester said, and he and Henry watched her walk away. She gave me a ball of yarn once, Henry said. I was probably 14, and we were on a school field trip downtown. I was so embarrassed, I threw it away. But the very next week, I needed it when I was working on a school project.
Men in this town learn their lesson young when it comes to Waverly women,
Lester said, reaching for the cane he'd rested against the tree. He slowly stood.
Whenever there's one around, sit up and pay attention.
The next afternoon, Claire heard Sydney's voice upstairs.
Where is everyone?
I'm down here, Claire called to her.
Soon she heard the creak of the dusty stairs as Sydney walked down to the basement. It was cool and dry, and sometimes grown men who had too much to do would knock on the front door and ask to go sit in the Waverly basement for a while because it cleared their thoughts and brought back their equilibrium. Sydney's footsteps drew closer as she followed the racks deeper into the basement toward the shine of Claire's flashlight. The light bulbs in the basement had all burned out in 1939, and what had started out as someone too tired to replace them had turned into a family tradition of keeping the basement in the dark. No one knew why they did it now, just that this was the way it had always been done.
"Where is Bay?" Sydney asked.
"Isn't she down here with you?"
"No, she likes to stay in the garden most of the time."
"She's okay." The tree stopped tossing apples at her when she started throwing them back at it. Claire handed Sydney the flashlight.
"Help me with this, will you? Shine here."
"Honeysuckle wine?" "The 4th of July celebration is next week. I'm counting the bottles to see how many we have to bring."
"I saw a bottle on the kitchen table when I came in," Sydney said as Claire counted.
"That's the rose geranium wine Fred gave back to me. He wouldn't let me return his money." "I think it might be a bribe to keep quiet," Claire said, then clapped her hands together to get rid of the dust.
34 bottles. I thought I made 40 last year.
No matter. This should be enough."
"Are you going to give it to Tyler?"
Claire took back the flashlight.
"Am I going to give what to Tyler?"
"The rose geranium wine."
"Oh,"
Claire said, walking away. Sydney was soon on her heels.
"Actually, I was sort of hoping you would take it to him for me."
"He's teaching his summer session classes," Sydney said. "He won't be around much."
"Oh."
Claire was glad Sydney couldn't see her confusion. She sometimes thought she was going crazy. Her first thought when she woke up was always how to get him out of her thoughts. And she would keep watch, hoping to see him next door, while plotting ways to never have to see him again. It made no sense. They reached the kitchen, and Claire closed and locked the basement door behind them.
"He's a good guy, Claire," Sydney said.
"I know.
Surprised the hell out of me, too.
Imagine that. Men can be good. Who would have thought?" Claire took the flashlight back to the storeroom and put it on the shelf where she kept candles and battery-powered lanterns. The electricity from her frustration caused the portable radio on the shelf to crackle to life as she passed it, and she jumped in surprise. She immediately turned it off, then leaned against the wall. This couldn't go on.
"He's not a constant," Claire said from the storeroom. "The apple tree is a constant. Honeysuckle wine is a constant. This house is a constant. Tyler Hughes is not a constant."
"I'm not a constant, am I?" Sydney asked. But Claire didn't answer. Was Sydney a constant? Had she really found her niche in Bascom? Or would she leave again? Maybe when Bay was grown, or if she fell in love? Claire didn't want to think about it.
The only thing Claire could control was not being the reason Sydney left, giving her reasons to stay. She would focus only on that. Claire took a deep breath and walked back out to the kitchen. "So, how's work?" she asked brightly. "Oh, my God, so busy, thanks to you." "I didn't do anything. You did." Sydney shook her head. "People look at me now like I'm a teacher or something. I don't understand it." "You've just learned the secret to my success," Claire said. "When people believe you have something to give, something no one else has, they'll go to great lengths and pay a lot of money for it." Sydney laughed. "So you're saying, if we're going to be strange anyway, we might as well get paid for it?" "We're not strange," Claire paused. "But exactly. You have cobwebs in your hair from the basement," Sydney said, walking over to her and sweeping them away with her fingertips. Territorial about Claire's hair now, Sydney had taken to simply walking up to her and tucking some strands behind Claire's ear, finger-combing the bangs across her forehead, or fluffing up the back. It was nice, like she was playing, like something they would have done as girls if they'd been close. "Where did you cut hair before?" Claire asked, watching Sydney's face close up as she smoothed out Claire's hair. She'd grown up so much while she was away. Sydney stepped back and tried to get the cobwebs off her fingertips, where they were sticking like tape. "It's been a few years, but in Boise, for a while." She gave up on the cobwebs and turned away. She grabbed the rose geranium wine off the table and hurried out the back door, a curious smell of men's cologne trailing after her. "I'm going to say hi to Bay, then I'll just take this over to Tyler." Ever since that day, Sydney mentally returned to the townhouse in Seattle when she remembered she'd left the photos of her mother there. The scent of David's cologne would appear around her without warning. Ceiling fans downstairs would turn on by themselves when the scent was particularly strong, as if to chase it away. When it hovered in the upstairs hallway at night, away from fans and night breezes, it paced, hot with anger. Those nights, Bay would crawl into bed with Sydney, and they would whisper about what they'd left behind. They'd talk in code, saying how happy they were to be away from there, how nice it was to be free. When they said this, they would cross their thumbs and make butterfly shadow puppets on the wall in the purple light coming through the window from Tyler's yard. Claire still wanted to know about where Sydney had been and what she'd done while she was away. Sydney knew she should tell her now, especially since sometimes even Claire would smell cologne in the house and wonder aloud where it had come from. But the cologne made Sydney realize what kind of danger she'd put her sister in by coming here, and she was doubly ashamed to admit her mistakes. Claire was doing so much for her. When Sydney walked outside, the scent of cologne faded in the garden, pummeled by the fragrance of apples and sage and earth. Sydney sat with Bay under the tree, and they talked about her day and about the 4th of July celebration, and about how one day they were going to walk over to the elementary school so Bay could see where it was. Ever since Claire had said it was okay for Bay to go into the garden, Bay spent several hours every day lying on the grass by the apple tree. When Sydney asked her why, she said she was just trying to figure something out. Sydney didn't press, and so much had happened that it was natural that Bay needed time to figure it out. After talking to Bay, Sydney walked over to Tyler's. She found him in his backyard, bringing a lawnmower out of his small shed. "I don't know, Tyler. Are you emotionally ready for all that cut grass again?" she called to him. He turned and laughed. "If I don't cut it soon, small neighborhood dogs are going to get lost in it. Even now, when Mrs. Kronowski can't find Edward, she comes over and beats the grass with a stick looking for him." "I come bearing a gift from Claire." She held up the wine bottle. Tyler hesitated, as if silently squelching the first thing he wanted to say. "You know, I'm having no luck figuring out your sister. She gives me gifts when she clearly doesn't like me. Is this a Southern thing?" "Oh, she likes you. That's why she's giving you this stuff. Do you mind if I have some of this? I'm a little shaky right now.
Sure, come on.
They walked into his kitchen through the back, and Tyler took 2 wine glasses out of his cabinet. As soon as he poured her a glass, she took a long drink of it.
What's wrong? He asked.
My mind went somewhere it shouldn't have a while back. It still spooks me.
Anything you want to talk about?
No. He nodded.
Okay. So what is this?
Tyler poured himself a glass and lifted it to his nose. Rose geranium wine. It's supposed to bring back good memories. He lifted his glass to her.
Here's to good memories.
Before he could drink it, Sydney blurted out, She's hoping this will make you remember someone else and forget her. Like the casserole with the snapdragon oil and the tarts with the bachelor's buttons. He lowered his glass.
I don't understand.
The flowers grown in our backyard are special. Or maybe it's the way the dishes made from them are prepared that makes them so special. They can affect the eater.
You're obviously immune.
Or maybe she's trying too hard. Maybe that changes the way it works. I don't know.
Tyler looked at her incredulously. She's trying to make me not interested in her?
Which means you're in already.
Let me tell you something about Claire. She likes things that don't go away.
So don't go away. Tyler leaned against the counter as if for support, as if someone had pushed him there. For a moment, Sydney wondered if she should have revealed something so personal about her sister. Claire obviously didn't want him to know. But then Tyler smiled, and she knew she'd done the right thing. It had just been such a long time since she'd brought anyone any real happiness that she'd forgotten what it was like. Claire was doing so much for her. This was something she could give Claire. She could show her that she could have happiness outside of what she knew, happiness with Tyler.
I'm not going anywhere, he said.
Good. Sydney looked away. The words of a good man could bring tears to a woman's eyes. She envied Claire for this, for Tyler. She'd known a lot of men after she left Bascom, none of them good. She didn't even think she'd know what to do with a good man now.
Drink up, she said, turning away and walking around the kitchen.
Tyler lifted his glass to his lips and took a sip.
This is good. Unusual, but good.
Welcome to Claire's world.
So what are your good memories? He asked.
She walked to his nook, past the easels, and looked out the window. It's so strange. My good memories are of this week. Everything in all my years of living, and this week has been the best week of my life. You?
It's good wine, but I'm not getting anything. I'm just thinking of Claire.
She smiled and drank some more.
You're hopeless.
Chapter 8 Bascom's 4th of July celebration was held every year on the square downtown. On the green by the fountain, families and church groups set up tables and canopies and brought food so everyone could sample delicacies, like a big potluck, before the fireworks display. Waverly's always brought honeysuckle wine so people could see in the dark. But whether or not the town knew it, the wine also brought about a few revelations every 4th of July. A side effect of being able to see in the dark, after all, is being aware of things you weren't aware of before. The Waverleys had a table off to the side. A most popular table, to be sure, but set apart from everyone else. Sydney fidgeted in her seat. Bay was over in the supervised children's area, making paper hats and getting her face painted, so it was just Sydney and Claire and the honeysuckle hooch. People would quietly come by for small paper cups of honeysuckle wine, like it was somehow hallowed, and every once in a while the sheriff would stroll by and ask, "Now this is non-alcoholic, right?" And Claire would answer straight-faced, as every Waverly had, "Of course." When Sydney was a teenager, the 4th of July always meant spending the day at a friend's pool, then showing up on the green just in time for the fireworks. She felt older than other people her age now. People like her old high school friends, most of whom had obviously come from backyard barbecues or pool parties and had tans and bathing suit straps peeking out from under their shirts. Emma was at the Presbyterian Church's table, talking with Eliza Beaufort. Knowing what she knew now, Sydney didn't envy that life of privilege anymore. Curious, then, that she felt sad for losing something she never had. Maybe she just missed friendship in general, the camaraderie of people her own age. Sydney looked away. "I can't remember the last time I sat here at the Waverly table," she said to Claire. "It has been a while." She took a deep breath. "It feels okay." "Why are you so uncomfortable? No one is going to throw rotten tomatoes at us."
"Right," Sydney said.
She could be like Claire and not care what anyone thought. She was even starting to dress like Claire. Crisp, sleeveless button-downs, khaki pants, Madras shorts, flowy sundresses. What Claire had said that day at the salon, that she had Waverly magic, changed her mindset completely. She felt like a Waverly. But right now, it was a little like living in a country where she didn't speak the language yet. She could dress like the natives, and it was nice, but a little lonely. "It's okay to be strange. I can get used to this." "We're not strange. We are who we are." "Hello, Evenel." Evenel had walked up to them and taken a cup of wine.
"Phew, I need this," she said, throwing back the wine like a shot. "There's so much to do. I need to give something to Bay."
She set the cup down and brought a truly gaudy brooch out of her tote bag. Faintly 1950s, the brooch was made of clear but yellowing crystal in a starburst pattern. "She's getting her face painted right now," Sydney said.
"Okay, I'll stop by there. Fred is helping me organize my house. He's been a real help. I found this in an old jewelry box we came across, and when I saw it, I knew I had to give it to Bay."
Claire leaned forward in her seat. "Fred has been helping you?"
"He's come up with a system for all the stuff I have. He created something called a spreadsheet."
"I've been offering to help you do that for years, Evenel," Claire said. Sydney turned to her curiously. Claire seemed hurt.
"I know. I didn't want to bother you with it. But since Fred is living with me, I..."
"Living with you?" Claire exclaimed. "I thought he was just staying with you for a while."
"Well, we figured he might as well be comfortable while he's there. He's turning the attic into his own little apartment and making some improvements around the house. It's been real handy having him around."
"You know if you ever need me, I'm here for you," Claire said.
"I know. You're a good girl."
She put the brooch back in her tote bag.
"After Bay, I have to take some nails to Reverend McQuayle and a mirror to Mary Beth Clancy. And then that will be it, and I'll meet Fred by the fountain. I hate big crowds. Always so much to do. I'll see you later."
"Bye, Evenel. Call me if you need me." Sydney snorted.
"Oh, yeah, we're strange."
"We are not," Claire said, distracted. "What do you think of Fred staying with Evenel?"
"I think it's sad that he and James are having problems."
Sydney shrugged. "But Evenel seems to like having him there." "Hmm." A few minutes, and another walk by from the sheriff later, Sydney nudged Claire. "In case you haven't noticed, Tyler keeps looking at you." Claire snuck a glance, then groaned. "Damn. You had to go and make eye contact. Now he's coming over."
"Oh, heaven forbid."
"Yeah, well, I'm not the only one who's being stared down. You've got one, too." Claire indicated the canopy across the green with Hopkins Dairy written on it. There was a handsome man there, blonde and lean and tan, scooping ice cream out of electric ice cream makers to put on paper cones. He was solid, as if made to withstand wind. He kept looking over to the Waverly table. "Does he think we need some ice cream? Maybe we look hot." "That's Henry Hopkins," Claire said. "Henry?" From a distance, Sydney couldn't make out his features. But now that she thought about it, there was something familiar about his hair, his deliberate movements. "I'd almost forgotten him." "I didn't realize you knew him." Claire started to stand, but Sydney caught her arm. "Let go. I forgot something in the van." "You didn't forget anything. You're trying to avoid Tyler. And yes, I knew Henry. We were friends, I guess, in elementary school. We grew apart after that." "Why?" Claire asked, tugging against Sydney's hand, her eyes darting to Tyler as he got closer. "Because I was a blind ass in high school," Sydney said. "You were not," was so. "We're not. Hello, ladies. Need a referee?" Sydney released Claire's arm now that her work was done. "Hi, Tyler." "Claire, your hair," Tyler said. And Claire's hand went to her hair self-consciously. She was wearing the white headband Evenel had given her, which made her look as young and innocent as she pretended not to be. "It's beautiful." "I had a dream. I dreamed your hair was like this once." "I'm sorry. There was really no way for that not to sound stupid." He laughed, then rubbed his hands together. "So, everyone keeps telling me I need to drink some of the Waverly's honeysuckle wine. Either it's a town tradition, or everyone is in on this, Claire trying to make me not interested in her game."
"What?"
"Sydney told me what you were trying to do with the dishes you were giving me." Claire turned to Sydney, who tried to look sheepish but felt otherwise unrepentant.
"Honeysuckle wine helps you see in the dark," Claire said stiffly. "Have it or don't have it. Walk into a tree when it gets dark. Fall over a curb. I don't care."
Tyler picked up a paper cup and smiled at her. "This means I'll be able to see you in the dark."
"I haven't worked out all the glitches in the recipe yet."
Tyler drank the wine, not taking his eyes off her as he did so. Sydney just sat back and smiled. It was like watching a dance when only one of the dancers knew the steps. When Tyler walked away, Claire rounded on her sister.
"You told him? Why are you so surprised? You should have known.
I'm predictable like that."
"You are not.
I am so.
Oh, go socialize and stop feeling your Waverly oats," Claire said, shaking her head.
But there it was, a hint of a smile, the beginning of something new and close between them. It felt good. Henry Hopkins could still remember the day he and Sydney Waverly became friends. Sydney was sitting alone inside the dome of the monkey bars during recess. He'd never understood why other kids didn't want to play with her, but he went along because that's what everyone else did. But that day there was something about her. She seemed so sad, so he went over to her and started climbing the bars above her. He wasn't actually going to talk to her, but he thought she might feel better having someone around. She watched him a while before she asked him,
"Henry, do you remember your mother?"
He'd laughed at her.
"Of course I do. I saw her this morning. Don't you remember yours?"
"She left last year. I'm starting to forget her. When I grow up, I'm never leaving my kids. I'm going to see them every day and not let them forget me." Henry remembered feeling ashamed, a feeling so intense he actually fell off the monkey bars. And from that day forward, he stuck like glue to Sydney at school. For 4 years, they played and ate lunch together and compared homework answers and buddied up on class projects. He had no reason to expect that, on their first day of middle school after summer break, things would be any different.
But then he'd walked into their homeroom, and there she was. She'd grown in ways that made his pubescent head spin. She looked like autumn when leaves turned and fruit ripened. She smiled at him, and he immediately turned around and left the room. He spent the rest of homeroom in the bathroom. Every time she tried to speak to him that day, he felt like fainting and he ran away. After a while, she stopped trying. It was so unexpected, that attraction, and it made him miserable. He wanted things back the way they were. Sydney was bright and fun and could tell things about people just by the way they wore their hair, which he thought was absolutely amazing. He told his grandfather about it, about how there was this girl who was just a friend, but suddenly things changed and he didn't know what to do. His grandfather said that things happened the way they were supposed to, and it was no use trying to predict what was going to come next. People liked to think otherwise, but what you thought had no practical influence on what eventually happened. You can't think yourself well. You can't make yourself fall out of love. He was sure Sydney thought he had abandoned her, like her mother, or that he didn't want to be her friend, like the other kids. He felt terrible. In the end, Hunter John Madison fell hard for her and did what Henry couldn't. He actually told her. Henry watched while Hunter John's friends became her friends, and she began to act like them, laughing at people in the hallways, even Henry. That was so long ago. He'd heard she was back in town, but he didn't think much of it. Just like before, he had no reason to expect that her coming back would make things any different. Then he saw her, and the whole thing started over again. That curious wanting, that sensation of seeing her again for the first time. Hopkins men always married older women, so he wondered if seeing her change, get older, made him feel like this. Like when she grew up over the summer before sixth grade, like coming back after 10 years looking wiser, more experienced.
"You're staring so hard you're gonna knock her over."
Henry turned to his grandfather, who was sitting in his aluminum lawn chair behind the tables. He was holding his cane and every once in a while called out to passers-by like a carnival barker. "I was staring."
"For the past 30 minutes, Lester said. "You haven't heard a word I've said."
"Sorry."
"Heads up. She's on the move."
Henry turned and saw that Sydney had left the Waverly table and was walking to the children's area. Her hair shone in the sun, bright like honey. She went to her daughter and laughed when her daughter put a paper hat on her head. Sydney said something to her. Her daughter nodded, and together they walked hand in hand toward him. They were walking toward him. He wanted to run to the bathroom, just like he did in middle school. When they approached the table, Sydney smiled. "Hi, Henry." Henry was afraid to move, for fear he would explode from the riot going on in his body. "Do you remember me?" Sydney asked. He nodded. "This is my daughter, Bay." He nodded again. Sydney looked disappointed, but shrugged it off and discussed the choices of ice cream with her daughter. There was chocolate mint, strawberry rhubarb, caramel peach, and vanilla coffee. It was his grandfather's idea. Give people something they don't know they like yet. They'll always remember you for it. The wives of some of the dairy workers were helping that day. Henry did some scooping, but it was clear the women were in charge. "Could we have 2 chocolate mint, please?" Sydney finally asked. Henry immediately scooped out small balls of ice cream and put them on the paper cones. Sydney watched him while he did it, her eyes on his hands, then traveling up his forearms, then finally to his face. She studied him as he handed them the cones. Still, he didn't say a word. He couldn't even smile. "It's nice to see you again, Henry. You look good." She and her daughter turned and walked away. Halfway across the green, She looked over her shoulder at him.
That was the most pitiful display I've ever seen, Lester finally said, cackling. I was shocked by a milking machine once when I was a boy. Knocked me off my feet. You look like I felt.
I can't believe I didn't say anything, Henry said.
Zap! That machine got me. Couldn't say a word. I just opened and closed my mouth like a fish, Lester said, and laughed some more.
He lifted his cane and poked Henry in the leg.
Zzzzap!
Henry jumped in surprise. Very funny, he said, and started to laugh. Evenel and Fred sat on the rock bench, circling the fountain. They waved as Sidney and Bay passed, eating ice cream. Bay had the ugly brooch Evenel had given her pinned to her pink T-shirt, and Evenel felt guilty. Bay was so conscientious and concerned for others' feelings that she felt she had to wear the pin just because Evenel gave it to her. But that wasn't a pin for a little girl. Why on earth did Evenel need to give her such a thing? She sighed. She might never know.
I'm nervous, Fred finally said, rubbing his hands on his neatly pressed shorts.
Evenel turned to him.
You look it.
Fred stood and paced. Evenel stayed where she was, in the shade of the oak leaf sculpture. Fred was hot and bothered enough for the both of them.
He said he'd be here to talk, in public.
What does he think I'm going to do if we're alone, shoot him? Men, you can't live with them, you can't shoot them.
How can you be so calm? How would you feel if your husband said he'd show up and didn't?
Given that he's dead, Fred, I wouldn't be real surprised.
Fred sat back down.
I'm sorry.
Evenel patted his knee. It had been nearly a month since Fred had asked for sanctuary in her home, and he had become an unexpected bright spot to her days. The whole arrangement was supposed to be temporary, but slowly, surely, Fred was moving in. He and Evenel spent days going through all her old things in the attic, and Fred seemed to enjoy the stories she told. He was footing the bill to renovate the attic space, and workers with nice posteriors started showing up, which Evenel enjoyed so much she shoved a chair to the base of the stairs just so she could sit and watch them walk up. It all had a nice ring of domesticity to it, and Fred would say he knew he deserved better than the way James was treating him, but sometimes, when Evenel would pass him the butter at dinner, or hand him a hammer to hold while she hung a picture on the wall, he would look at what she'd given him, then look back at her with such expectation that her heart would crack like dry wood for him. Even with all his brave words, he still secretly harbored the belief that one day Evenel was going to give him something that would make everything all right with James.
"It's getting late," Fred said. "People are already putting out blankets. Maybe I missed him."
Evenel saw James approach before Fred did. James was a tall, handsome man. He'd always been very thin, the way moody, creative poets with long fingers and soulful eyes were thin in days of old. Evenel had never had a bad word to say about James. No one did, really. He worked for an investment firm in Hickory, and kept to himself. Fred had been his one and only confidant for over 30 years. But suddenly that had changed, and neither Fred nor anyone else in town could figure out why. But Evenel had her suspicions. You stick around long enough in this life, and you start to understand its ebbs and flows. There was a type of craziness caused by long-term complacency. All the Burgess women in town, who never had less than 6 children each, walked around in a fog until their children left home. When their youngest finally left the nest, they always did something crazy, like burn all their respectable high-neck dresses and wear too much perfume. And anyone who had been married for more than a year could testify to the surprise of coming home one day and finding that your husband had torn down a wall to make a room bigger, or your wife had dyed her hair just to make you look at her differently. There were midlife crises and hot flashes. There were bad decisions. There were affairs. There was a certain point when sometimes someone said, "I've just had enough." Fred went still when he finally saw James approach.
"I'm sorry I'm late. I almost didn't make it."
James was a little out of breath, and a fine sheen of perspiration dotted his forehead.
"I was just at the house. I took a few things, but the rest is yours. I wanted to tell you that I have an apartment in Hickory now."
Ah, Evenell thought. That was the reason James wanted Fred to meet him here. So James would know when Fred wasn't going to be in the house, and he could take things out without having to discuss it first with Fred. One look at Fred, and Evenell knew he'd figured that out, too.
"I'm taking early retirement next year, and I'll probably move to Florida. Or maybe Arizona. I haven't decided yet."
"So, that's it?" Fred asked. And Evenell could tell there were too many things he wanted to say, all fighting to get out. Ultimately, the only thing that escaped was,
"That's really it?" "For months, I was angry. Now, I'm just tired," James said. And he leaned forward and put his elbows on his knees. "I'm tired of trying to show you the way. I dropped out of school for you. I came here to live with you because you didn't know what to do. I had to tell you that it was all right for people to know you were gay. I had to drag you out of the house to show you. I had to plan the meals and what we did with our free time. I thought I was doing the right thing. I fell in love with your vulnerability in college, and when your father died and you had to leave, I was terrified you wouldn't be able to make it on your own. It's taken me a long time to realize that I did you a great disservice, Fred. And myself also. By trying to make you happy, I prevented you from knowing how to figure it out on your own. By trying to give you happiness, I lost my own.
I can do better. Just tell me..."